Welcome, welcome. Sounds like we have a good crowd in here. I'm Donna Pomeranz, president of the California Council of the Blind. Most of you know me, and for those who don't, welcome, welcome, and I look forward to getting to know you. I realize that people are still attempting to get their seats, and so that's why, you know, we're hearing a bit of the commotion and everything around here. If we can, oh, thank you for the reminder. If we can please have everyone turn off your cell phones or put it on to vibrate. I have mine on vibrate. If you're not sure how to do that on most cell phones, you can do the lower right-hand button on the panel of your cell phone, and that most of the time turns it to vibrate. It does on mine. All right. I think Roger said something smart over there, but he's on the side where, you know, I don't have as much hearing, so I quite didn't hear that, so. and Jeff says selective hearing. I think I'm going to have trouble with Jeff, that character, now that he's no longer president. He's immediate past president. So that's true. So he'll heckle me from the audience, I think. Okay, everyone. Welcome, welcome. And what I would like to do is go ahead and start off with Pastor Rick Cole to do our invocation. Pastor Rick Cole is from Capital Christian Center here in Sacramento, California. So I will give the microphone over to Pastor Cole, and if we can please have silence for a moment.
Thank you. They gave me a microphone, too. Thank
Perfect.
You. All
Thank
right.
You.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be with you today. And Deborah Thompson is a member of your council and member of our church. So, and if you haven't heard her sing, you need to ask her to sing sometime. She sings like a bird and sings in our choir. And a wonderful, wonderful part of our family here in Sacramento. So thank you for the invitation to start off your meeting here today with a word of prayer. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your goodness to us, and I pray your blessing upon everyone here in this very important, inspirational gathering. Lord, I pray you would bless each one with your supernatural wisdom and giving clear direction for our life. That you'll bless us with creativity, with courage, with ability, and with abundance. That you would bless us with a great family, good friends, and good health. That you would bless us with faith, with favor, and with fulfillment. Lord, we pray you would bless us with success, with supernatural strength, with promotion and divine protection. That you would bless us in the city and in the country when we go in and when we come out. We ask, Lord, that any negative word that's ever been spoken over our lives would not have impact. It would just be broken and not have any influence, for we know those aren't your words to us. And we pray that everything that we do and set our hands to will prosper and succeed. And I pray your blessing for each and every one here, that the days ahead will be filled with joys and filled with victories. And bless this conference and the convention, the things that we'll learn and share together, and the relationships that are being built. Just bless each one in your great and mighty name, we pray. Amen.
Thank you very much, Pastor Cole. Thank you. Now, I have the Pledge of Allegiance next. And at the creation of the program, we did not have anyone scheduled to do the Pledge of Allegiance. Sometimes I've learned that things will happen and I don't know about them. So I'm asking if we have anyone, and we don't. So if I can please have everyone stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. And to my knowledge, we do not have a flag in the room, so someone says the flag is in our hearts. You can put your right hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic
which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty, justice for all.
Thank you. You may be seated. Okay. Before we continue on to the next part of our program, I have Laura Hover, who is here from the hotel, and she would like to just say a few brief words welcoming us to the hotel.
The Associate Director of Sales here at the DoubleTree, and I just wanted to take a brief second to say thank you so much for coming and seeing us over here. I don't know if you remember me or not, but I was at the Hilton across the street for about 11 years, and I truly, truly appreciate you following me across the street. The staff, all I've heard while you guys have been here, and I'm sure I'm going to hear it throughout the weekend, has been so much in love with you all. They say you're sweet and wonderful, and the whole staff is smiling. So thank you, thank you, thank you again for coming to the DoubleTree. Enjoy your stay with us, and I hope to see you back here again in the future. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. So before we go into our next presentation, how about a door prize? I think I heard no. Oh. All righty. I am. All right.
It's a Braille t-shirt from Specialty Adaptations.
We have a Braille t-shirt from Specialty Adaptations.
And the Braille message on the t-shirt says, I read Playboy for the article.
And the Braille message on the t-shirt says, I read Playboy for the article. That's what they all say. All right, and we are having one of our speakers draw.
Valerie
Reese-Lehrman, are you in the room? Valerie, are you in the room? If you are, please either stand or raise your hand. Oh, Valerie doesn't read Playboy for the articles. Okay. All righty. Next name. No, she did not make it. We drew a name for someone who wasn't able to come, so we'll go again. Dan Smith, are you in the room? Nope. Okay. Here we go. Next name. Mary Lou Ruiz. Mary Lou is working. She's at the registration table, and if I remember correctly, when you are working at the registration table, you get the prize. Yay! Okay. The next part of the program is the Department of Rehabilitation, partnering in the interest of employment, independence, and equality for all Californians with disabilities. And we have Tony Sauer, Director of the Department of Rehabilitation, Sacramento, California. We have Joe Xavier, Deputy Director, Specialized Services Division, Department of Rehabilitation, Sacramento, California. And if I might. Okay. And here we go. Tony Sauer was appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger as Director of the Department of Rehabilitation, DOR, within the Health and Human Services Agency on June 12, 2007. He has earned this appointment with over 15 years of experience in various aspects of policy, program development, and administration of programs and services to increase the equality of opportunity for persons with disabilities. After a successful career as a as a professional cabinet maker and woodworking instructor. We have several people I know who do that as well. In 1990, Mr. Sauer decided to focus on his passion around advocacy and begin working and began working in the disability field. Over the next 18 years, he held executive level positions in four community-based and government agencies serving people with disabilities. Mr. Sauer was paralyzed at the age of 18 from a motorcycle racing accident. He earned a master's degree in management and disability services from the University of San Francisco and was a fellow in the health leadership program at the Sierra Health Foundation and University of Southern California's School of Policy, Planning, and Development. During his employment and education preparation, he was a consumer. He was a consumer of the Department of Rehabilitation. Mr. Sau says his biggest sense of accomplishment is his two daughters, Stephanie and Krista?
Yes.
Who have both graduated from college. That's wonderful. That is Director Sauer. And next member of this panel is Joe Xavier. And Joe Xavier has over 26 years of experience in business and public administration, as well as many years participating in advocacy and community organizations. Can you please turn off your cell phone or set it to vibrate? Thank you so much. Joe currently serves as the Department of Rehabilitation's DOR Deputy Director for Specialized Services Division as appointed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger on April 21st, 2010. Working for DOR within the California Health and Human Services Agency, Joe has held many positions and directed numerous special projects, applying his exemplary leadership and managerial skills. Additionally, Joe is a graduate of the California Health and Human Services Agency Leadership Academy and a fellow of the Health Leadership Program at the Sierra Health Foundation and University of Southern California's School of Policy, Planning, and Development. If you would please give a nice warm welcome to Director Sauer and Joe Xavier.
Okay, thank you everyone, and thank you Donna. So this is Tony, and I'm going to go first, and then Joe and I will kind of do a tag team throughout our presentation. I think we definitely need to shorten our introductions, Joe, or we're not going to have enough time to talk. Well, welcome to Sacramento, and best wishes on yet another successful convention. My car wanted to take me across the freeway, but somehow we figured out to come over here to the DoubleTree. As the manager said earlier, that I noticed a lot more groups are moving over here, so she must be quite the personality to bring her folks over with her. And again, thank you for inviting us here to speak, and it's much better for us to be here in person than to hear through emails and teleconferences, so we're glad to be here, and fortunately it's in Sacramento, so we can attend. I'll talk in a minute about the travel restrictions that we're all facing as state employees. And those are a result of the tremendous budget deficit that we're in, which is projected at about $25 billion. Of those $25 billion, about $12.5 billion are projected in cuts, and the governor is also penciling in $25 billion in revenue, which is based upon the extension of the current tax rate, which you've all been probably hearing about over the last few weeks, and you're hearing about the teachers' unions this week, some getting arrested at the Capitol over that very issue. And they've got another $1.9 billion in other solutions. But the gap, according to the media, is actually closing a bit because the revenues are increasing. People are finally starting to spend money and pay capital gains taxes. So there is a perception that $25 billion will be reduced to closer to $15 billion. But that still does mean a lot of cuts. And we've been cut consistently every year for the last 4 years now. And it has not been easy working in state government and has not been easy being a person with a disability, as I'm sure you're all feeling, with cuts all around you, cuts to Social Security, SSI, cuts to in-home supportive services, cuts to Medi-Cal, Medicaid. It's not easy, and therefore our department, we're really trying to be available for folks who do go to work to help supplement their income and to move on to different stages of their life. The governor will be releasing his revised budget on Monday. I understand it's around 11 o'clock. Did you need something done? Okay. Yeah, of course. I think Donna wants to make an announcement here.
We have Assemblymember Dickinson, who has just arrived, and Director Sauer has graciously allowed me to hand him the microphone, and please welcome us to Sacramento.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and I apologize for interrupting the dissertation on the budget. I was hoping you'd have a solution.
I'll stay around.
Before I swear, you got one. Okay, yeah. And I apologize. I know I'm a few minutes late, so please forgive me for that. It's a little bit of running around today. But I will just take a quick moment or two to say thank you for being here in Sacramento. It's really my honor and privilege to represent the people of the 9th Assembly District, which is, yes. All right. it's essentially the city of Sacramento. But for those of you who may not be familiar with my background, and I can't imagine that you aren't, but for those of you who may not be, I spent nearly 17 years as a Sacramento County Supervisor before moving to the Assembly this last December. And in my capacity locally, actually served for about 20 years total as a non-elected person, and then as a supervisor on the Sacramento Regional Transit District Board of Directors, which gave me a firsthand opportunity in both of those roles to have some direct opportunities to work on matters of great concern to visually impaired residents of Sacramento and visitors to our community, and I continue to be very concerned about making sure that as we approach the issues of state policy, that we do so keeping in full inclusion in mind for all Californians, the opportunity for full participation in California's mainstream of life. I know that there are a couple of pieces of legislation that you're working on this year, a bill by Mr. Portantino and a bill by Mr. Swartz. Swanson. While I haven't had them come before a committee I sit on yet, they both look like they have great merit to make sure that the ID cards continue to go, or notice renewal notices, I should say, go out from DMV, and make sure you have the opportunity and the ability to look at legislative language as it changes over time, and have that disseminated in a form that is feasible for those who are visually impaired to follow and make sense of. And I will just say, since you're talking about the budget, a quick word on the budget. You know, it's quite a difference moving from the local level to the state level with regard to how budgets get addressed. Of course, at the local level, you have to balance the budget by the start of the fiscal year, and you've got to find a way to do that, whether it's coming across some additional revenues or it's making cuts or a combination of the two. There's really no alternative, though, to starting the year with a balanced budget. And for 17 years as a county supervisor, that's exactly what I was engaged in, and of course quite used to. The state of California works a little differently, and has over the last several years, in particular, in my estimation, made the increasingly larger and larger mistake of relying more and more in one form or another of borrowing to balance the budget when agreements were reached. In many instances, because the legislature and the governor were unwilling to face the hard question of whether they were going to agree to raise revenues or make cuts or some combination, but rather they tried, and both parties had pursued this path in many instances, had tried to find other ways to plug the gap. One of the things I think we can fairly say about Governor Brown when he came back to being governor this time around was that he presented a difficult, in many cases, very hard, but straightforward, honest, and sober plan for closing our $26 billion budget gap and putting California back on a stable financial footing that would allow us to build our economy in the state back to a place where we have much lower employment, much higher productivity, and a much stronger statewide economy. Consistent with that, many of us believe that he proposed a realistic path too, as office, and cast some very hard votes in March. As Democrats, we supported some cuts in programs that were of a character, a nature, and a depth which caused us terrific consternation. And yet, we recognized the fundamental truth of what the governor had proposed, which was, it would take a combination of some reductions in expenses as well as the extension of some existing revenues to get us to that equilibrium point so necessary for fiscal stability in the state. I'm really regretful to say that our Republican colleagues thus far have been unwilling to join us in this effort. And I hope that in the time between now and the middle of June, we will in fact have a honest, straightforward dialogue over solving the state's remaining budget gap, not one that's built on more fund shifts and taking money away from our seniors and our children and our vulnerable families and vulnerable populations, but one that recognizes that Californians are in fact less taxed today than they were 20 years ago. And less taxed 20 years ago than they were 50 years ago. The per capita tax burden on us as Californians is actually lower today than it was when Pete Wilson was governor, for example, in the early 90s. And so as we look at what we need to do to invest in California to build a stronger financial future for our state, I'm hopeful that our Republican colleagues will come to the table with realism and seriousness as well, and we will in fact address successfully the budget challenge we have before us. In any case, we will continue to work toward that goal and that purpose. I know I speak for all my colleagues in the Democratic Caucus in the Assembly in telling you that we are absolutely dedicated to the proposition that we will not continue to make cuts in those programs that are so critical to Californians in need. We simply will not do that. We know and understand the kind of difficulties that those most in need in California all already live with. And it is incumbent upon us to keep in mind that the measure of a society is how it treats the least of its members. What it does to lift up those who are in most of need of assistance and those who are vulnerable. That's why many of us aspired to serve in public office. It's certainly is a great motivation for me, and that's what makes me so pleased that I could come and spend a few moments with you, express a few thoughts to you, and I wish you the best in your meetings here today, in your advocacy in the Capitol, and I'll be sure to keep an watch so that we can continue to work together this year and in the years ahead. Have a great time. Enjoy Sacramento. Thank you very much. Thanks, Don.
Thank you so very much.
And we will give the microphone back to Director Sauer.
Okay. Thank you, Donna. And thanks for those great words, Councilwoman Dickerson. So continuing on with the budget issues, the Department of Rehabilitation's budget, we have been very fortunate that our budget has remained stable due to a couple of factors. One is our stimulus funding has been very helpful, helping us the last couple of years. Our budget's about $416 million this year, with only $55 million of that coming from the general fund. We have about 1,880 positions, although with the hiring freeze that I'll talk about in a minute, we have about 200 vacancies currently, which is making it harder and harder to continue services. We've been fortunate, again, to remain fairly stable. We have requirements under the Department of Education Rehab Service Administration that we have standards indicators that we must meet. One of those is what we call 26s. Those are our successful closures, people who have gained successful employment. And that number is down to 10,719 in the last fiscal year, which is down about 3,000 from where we were when I started 3 years ago. Donna, I see your hand up.
Or? No, I was actually calling for
Ed. Okay. I think he's coming your way. So, and in blind field services, the successful closures were about 1,004. And Joe can talk a little bit more about what that means. The good news is 30% of those were successful competitive closures, which sounds like a low number, but it's up from 10% just a few years ago. So we're working more towards successful closures, competitive closures with our blind field services. And the average weekly earnings to meet that are $7 per hour or higher, and it's the average is considerably higher than that in California. Some of the not so good news is our Social Security reimbursements are down considerably, and those reimbursements are based upon when someone who's on SSI goes to work, we can bill Social Security for the funds that we put into their education and to helping them go to work, and they will get reimbursed, and then those funds go on to fund independent living and other programs. But because of the economy, because of furloughs, because of other issues, they're down considerably over the last couple of years. And I'm going to try to go through this quickly because I'm still on page one, and Joe and I have about 10. I'm trying to race through this. We have some staffing updates. Megan Juring has now been appointed to Joe's old position as our Independent Living External Affairs Deputy Director. Teresa Coriella just started 2 weeks ago as our new Deputy of Administrative Service Division. We have several retirements recently which have impacted our department. We have a lot of retirements, but these are the key level positions. Luciana Profascia, who's our Chief Deputy Director, retired in December but is continuing as a retired annuitant. And Lana Frazier is the same way. She's continuing as a retired annuitant. Ralph Black, who was our assistant deputy of legislation, who many of you know. Ralph retired as our assistant deputy of legislation and is back, but only part-time doing specifically reasonable accommodation issues. We've been able to use our funding to really help him focus on our reasonable accommodations. And then Art Lopez, who is our employment preparations north, retired, and that position's still vacant. We still have vacancies, key vacancies that affect our blind field services, and those are our OCB administrator is vacant currently. Our San Diego district administrator, that is vacant, and we don't have exemption to fill that. We did get an exemption to fill our OCB administrator and also our OCB stationary engineer. We only had three exemptions right now that we pushed really hard for, and those are two of the three. The other one is we have an exemption to fill by, I think, 21 of our support service assistant, both general and interpreters, which will really impact a lot of our blind staff in a good way. It's been very difficult for our folks with visual impairments and hearing impairments and also other disabilities to do their jobs without having SSA positions filled. So we're very grateful we got that exemption. I'm going to talk briefly about our stimulus funding. As I mentioned earlier, the President's American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and Congress's funding of $56.5 million for voc rehab really helped our department continue providing as best services we could in this very awful economy. Of that $56.5 million that went to voc rehab, over 20% went to services for the blind specifically, which is a fairly high amount. Fortunately, nobody else has complained, but I think it's a good thing. We had some real areas we needed to work on, including $7 million for the Orientation Center for the Blind upgrades, just over $2 million for our BEP projects, and another $2 million for blindness-specific services. I'm happy that we've done that. It was something that was needed, particularly the remodeling Orientation Center for the Blind. And I was fortunate yesterday I was in the Bay Area and I stopped by and got to see the progress. It's slow but sure. We have about 100 days left before the ARRA funding goes away. And Warren assures me that we'll be done with that remodeling, and maybe at some point you can go by and tour the facility. There's been some really nice upgrades to the site, and also upgrades of the curriculum that Warren is working on with the staff there, that he actually has the staff now working through to refine the suggestions that he has. We expect to fully expend our stimulus funding. Not all the states are going to do that. We're fortunate that we've got staff really working to move along. There's going to be no extension of time for stimulus. It ends on September 30th, and we have to have all the bills into our department by the middle of November so we can get them paid by the end of December, because then it's done. And we're a little concerned about that, but I think we're going to make the deadline. To date, overall, we've received about $61 million. We've spent and expended about $61 million of our total stimulus package, which is 98.3% have either been obligated or expended. That created 252 full-time equivalent jobs, including retired annuitants, student assistants, and paid internships. Additionally, about $20 million for the cooperative partnerships, funding and grants and contracts. Plus the independent living and older individuals who are blind have been funded with the stimulus funds. And they allowed for 36 CRP, those are community rehab partnership contracts. We funded 9 new BEP facilities. And we just announced in May we're going to be doing a $1,000 placement bonus for successful placement in 26 closures through September. That's an effort to expend all our money and also help those providers that are having a tough time with our reimbursement rate. And we have approximately 853 job training contracts have been developed or in the process of being developed with 30 small businesses. So we've been very fortunate with the ARRA funding to get the money out the door and to really help improve the economy and also assist people with disabilities. I mentioned a hiring freeze earlier. That was issued on February 15th. It applies to all vacant, seasonal, and full-time positions, and it also prohibits hiring outside contractors to compensate for the hiring freeze. And the very few exemptions we have to go to the governor's office for approval. So as you can tell, they're very limited. And those three that I mentioned earlier, our OCB administrator, our facilities person at Orientation Center for the Blind, and our SSAs have been the only exemptions that our department has received thus far. We also have a restriction on travel that was handed down on April 26th. All of our out-of-state travel has been frozen for several months. Now we have in-state travel that is essentially frozen. Nothing that's discretionary can happen for state employees, including conferences and things that are not mandatory. And any out-of-state travel has to continue to be approved by the governor's office. Only things that are mission-critical or no cost to the state will be considered. And to be mission-critical, it means that something that's worth for enforcement responsibilities or auditing or revenue collection or something that requires a statute or a function required by statute or contract. Job-required training or necessary to maintain or licensure will also be approved, but other things that are training and conference-related are off the table until the budget crisis starts to resolve itself. And also, if there is a training that's mandatory, only a minimum number of staff can attend. So, as I mentioned earlier, we're grateful you're here in Sacramento because Joe and I probably could be here if you weren't. And we're trying to do more and more by video conferencing. Fortunately, our department was able to acquire video conferencing capabilities in our district offices around the state in our main office in Sacramento. And we are doing more and more training and meetings via video conference, which is working. So now I'm going to hand it over to Joe, and he's going to talk about our VR modernization, and I'll come back. And Joe, I'll kind of keep an eye on the time for us.
So push me along if I'm – is this on?
Yes.
Going, test. Okay. So VR mod, you guys have heard about this in some fashion or form over the past number of almost years, it seems like. So finally we get to talk a little bit more about it, and here hopefully in a few weeks – we'll be able to talk a lot more. But just so you know, this morning we had a meeting with all of our blind field services district staff. So all the counselors around the state, supervisors, and all the support staff, we were on a two-hour video and teleconference call talking about VR mod. What is it? Well, it's really a modernization of two key things. One is the electronic record system, which is a case management system that is about as old as I am. And that's pretty doggone old. And we are finally modernizing that. It is being piloted. It is being rolled out. It will be deployed, I believe, June, July of this year. The second piece is the reformulating our service delivery model into a team approach that's built around the consumer. And let me step back here and say that there's no way I can do justice to describing this very thorough project in a very short period of time, but I'll give you a flavor for it. I will be here for the weekend, so I'll be glad to entertain questions. And our staff are, of course, now much more familiar with it because we've had the opportunity to brief them, so I'm sure you'll be able to engage with them on that. Why was the department required to maintain this confidentiality? That's the big question. Why haven't you been able to talk? Well, there's a couple of things. One, it's a work in progress. It has control agency approvals that we have to go through, and until we have those approvals, we're not able to share, to talk. Is it the way we like to do it? It's the way we have to do it, whether we like it or not. The other piece of this is to honor the contractual obligations and some of the statutes that apply to contracts in terms of when rank and file staff are notified about these types of projects. Why are we modernizing our service delivery structure, you ask? One is that there's a federal regulatory change a number of years ago that we need to comply with, our CSPD, which is a comprehensive system of personnel development, nice short acronym, that had to be modernized. Two, to improve and stay relevant, to increase the capacity to serve our consumers, to bring about efficiencies and cost effectiveness, provide more, better services with the same dollars that we have, and to decrease routine and redundant workload that sometimes occurs by multiple staff. This really is to focus really on a consumer and improving the quality of the services to the consumer. What's the goal? Comply with the federal mandates. There are five non-delegable functions that the federal requirements require that a qualified rehab professional, QRP, perform those five non-delegable functions. They are determining eligibility, determining the level, the severity of disability, approving the plan, approving amendments to the plan, and case closure. Those functions must be performed by the QRPs. So this brings us into compliance with that. To implement a more efficient team model, one of the things that we have heard from our counselors and one of the things that Tony had committed to when he began his administration was to find a way to provide more face time for the consumer and the counselor. I tell my story routinely, and I recall the conversations that my two counselors and I had, Jim Pucci and Jerry Jones, and what I recall about that, it's the face-to-face conversations, it's the conversations about where I was going, what I needed to do to get there. I don't recall anything about the paperwork. I know we had to do it, but I don't recall about it, and that's, you know, one of the commitments that Tony had brought to this administration was to find a way to do that. We believe this is going to be a step in that direction. What are the key aspects of this? Well, the first thing that needed to occur for us to be able to break the cone of silence was to notify the unions. May 2nd, they were notified. You are probably going to have a lot more questions than I'm going to answer in a short period of time. But for those of you that are taking notes, dor.ca.gov, right on the homepage, is a link to VRMOD. I encourage you to go there to take a look at those materials because we are publishing as much as we can, being as transparent as we can about it so that not only are our staff informed, like I said, we've had a number of discussions with them now, but that our stakeholders and our community partners are also informed. So that's a resource for you. What have we done to inform staff? Supervisors, since May 2nd, because we could not have discussions with staff until noticing of the unions. So May 2nd, they were noticed. And the supervisors had unit meetings with their staff. Staff had meetings, also participated in their local district meetings, and today we have the district-wide meeting. Another key aspect of this is beginning in October, we're going to have a pilot. Each district will have at least one pilot where they're actually going to take this team formation and put it to play. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of questions about how to. How will we do filing? How will we handle a number of the functions that we need to handle? And the purpose of that pilot is to flush out all the how to so that when we roll this out statewide, we've worked out as many of the bumps and bugs as we can. I'm just scrolling through this, and about all I have in the VR model. So, Tony, you want to pick up there?
Sure. And as Joe mentioned, he'll be here the rest of today and part of tomorrow. If you do have questions you want to take offline or if we have time at the end of our little talk here, we can answer some of those. But change is never easy for folks, and it could be the best change in the world, but some people like the way they are. As Joe mentioned, the Voc Rehab program, as we know it, is almost 50 years old in California, and we felt as though it just was a time to make some shifts, and it seems that the folks who have in the field who understand what's going on are very comfortable with it, although we are going to have some adjustments. We'll do some trials of it, and we'll make adjustments as we go forward. The next thing I want to talk about quickly is our state plan forums that we've held. We wrapped up the final one yesterday in Berkeley. I see some folks here in the room. I know Brian testified yesterday, Brian Bashan. We've been gathering great input. We had three of the hearings. One was in Sacramento, and we video linked Fresno to save cost. And then we had the second one in Garden Grove. And then the third one, of course, the final one yesterday. We will still take public comments. I think the date closes the 18th. So if you have comments, if you go to our website, you can comment on our draft state plan. We invited folks, and we still invite you to comment on the six new goals for the vocational rehabilitation and supported employment program. And we will use the input to help develop where we go over the next year. And it's been very helpful. The state plan hearings, when I came here 4 years ago, one or two people show up. We did not really have a lot of valuable input. And we've changed the format a bit. We've had, I think we had around 20 speakers yesterday and a couple who signed up ahead of time and a couple more who talked at the end. And we're really gaining valuable input and we see themes that come out. So for your input and guidance on those. I'll give a little bit of update of our electronic recording system update. You've been hearing about this for many years. Those of you who have ever worked in department, and I see a few of our staff here, know that the system that we use to maintain consumer files, electronic system, is a 20-year-old system. It was created in the 80s and implemented in the early 90s, and it was outdated before we even started with it 20 years ago. Staff have been able to fumble along and do case recording and notes. It's not user friendly. The new, particularly the younger staff that come in who are used to using the interfaces that we have now, it really drives them kind of crazy. Well, our ERS is finally up and running. We have a trial project going on right now in our Laguna office, which is south of Sacramento. We've had the trainer sessions in April, and staff who are using it are loving it. We're finding a few bugs to work out, but nothing major. And I believe 19 other states are using this particular product, although we've had some tailor things made for our usage. And at this point, the accuracy, I understand, is 98%, which is pretty darn good. It has been a long road getting here. It's been talked about for at least 10 years, and to be able to pull this thing off during our administration feels really good. Another thing that will help get the counselors and the supervisors away from their computers and with the consumers is our hope, that there'll be less time doing data entry. And we're hearing from the trial folks, even those who are not technically savvy at all, that it's cutting their time doing documentation and entry by half, by two-thirds, and that's exciting to hear. So now I'm going to hand it back over to Joe, who's going to talk about our rehabilitation resource database.
Okay, and some of you may have heard about this. This was formerly called the Community Resources Program Database, and with input from our BAC and some answers that the BAC is still waiting for, it's truly more reflective of the Rehabilitation Resources Database, and I'll simplify this in the interest of time. The database is essentially to bring into a central library, a central point, the resources that are available for the consumer, whether they are at home or the consumer and the counselor while they're in the office, to view the services that are available and key elements of that services to help them achieve their employment for independence, to move them into the employment and independence and equality that we all work through and work for. There's a couple of things that I would mention, bring to your attention about that. One is that we are going to be establishing a work group that includes consumers and our service providers, and there's a representation from our blind advisory committee to help define what those key elements that need to be there. There's also a couple of issues that we'll need to overcome in terms of what is publicly facing. For example, in our ISPs, a lot of them use personal information as their identifiers. And so we got to be careful about that kind of stuff. So there's some mechanical and logistical considerations that we're working through with that. And the other thing is that the Blind Advisory Committee had very much wanted to ensure was included here is that it did not just include CRPs, community rehabilitation programs, but that it also included ISPs as well as for-profit vendors. So i.e. the term rehabilitation resources database, because it will include all three of those components. Let me just scroll through here. I think in the interest of time, I think that gives you a little bit of a taste about that. And again, I'll be here. I'm trying to not read everything in detail to give us the hook here before too long.
We have a few extra minutes, Jim.
So, and I don't want to just take all the time up on one part. We have about 10 pages of updates to share with you.
Okay. What do you want? Yeah. Which one next? So the, I had you going on further, Joe. So I'm going to look at here. Do you want to do miscellaneous? We did the hiring freeze.
Do you want to do miscellaneous? You want me to do it?
No, you go ahead. Okay, all right. So I talked about the hiring freeze. The Rehab Service Administration has a, normally we have a 3-year review process with them, RSA. Brian probably be happy to know this, is that they've extended that now. Next one will be in 2014. I think it's about a 5-year review process, and they, which means, that the states that aren't having big issues, they're going to let us kind of do our jobs and not spend days and weeks doing reviewing processes and auditing. We still have a lot of other audits to deal with, but not to have to do those all the time. The SSA, which is the Support Service Assistant General Exam, which would be a lot of the support service folks for our blind staff, that exam went live on 2/16, the electronic exam on February 16th, which means interested applicants can apply and become eligible for hiring 24/7. They don't have to wait until we do an exam. At any point, they can go on to State Personnel Board's website, do the exam, and be eligible, which lets us hire folks much quicker. That was an exciting bit of work that we did with State Personnel Board and our staff. It's the SSAG, Support Service Assistant General. There's the G and the D. I'm sorry, I, which is interpreter for the deaf. Okay. Program updates, Joe, you want to do those? Or?
Sure.
Okay.
So I think Tony now gets to sit back while I go through all the program updates. So about a year ago when I was appointed by the governor, I had a chance. I actually was in Burlingame where you guys were, and I had not been appointed. But since that time, a number of people have asked me, so, Joe, what is your vision for the Blind Field Services, BEP, et cetera? And I think it's very important because I think the vision is really about where do we want to be? Where do we want to go? What does this look like in 2020, 2030? And so what I use to guide the work that I do, the work that I help the staff and the managers that they actually carry out, and I'll make it very simple. To me, it's all about every Californian who's blind or visually impaired that wants to work has a job. And every single one who's blind or visually impaired who doesn't think they can go to work gets the counseling, gets the services to overcome those barriers. I reflect on my past. I reflect on my life. And I'll tell you, I had an opportunity a few days ago to speak to 16 and 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds who are finishing high school. And Georgetta, who's one of our counselors in the Sacramento District, brought them all in, some 50 or 60 of them, and had all these different organizations come in, including a CCB, and present to them. And as I shared with them, I realized my independence when that check hit my pocket and I got to do what I want, when I wanted, with whom I wanted. Okay? And I think that that's true for any of us. So that's what drives me. That's what keeps me going. That's what helps me push through another executive order, another cut, another challenge that we face. Let me share with you some program updates. The OCB administrator, Tony has already alluded. I mean, if you think about in this environment, in this time, we got 3 exemptions. 2 for OCB, 1 for staff to support our blind field services counselors, as well as provide interpretive services. That's pretty damn good because we only got 3. So to me, that speaks kudos to, you know, where Tony has placed a lot of the value and in his administration as well to address the needs that we have. So to that end, let me talk a little bit about the OCB administrator. By now, you've got to know that we have been doing a statewide search. We've done this by bringing together not just ourselves, but we asked the Blind Advisory Committee, California Council for the Blind and the National Federation of the Blind of California to identify a representative to work with us on conducting this recruitment, the screening and the selection for this. The week after, we're going to be holding interviews to fill that position. We got the exemption, so we need to move sooner than later to fill that. I'm just looking through my notes here. I think that one of the other things that is important to recognize about that position is that I think it was a couple of years ago, we made that what is called a staff services manager 2 position. One of the really key things about that that I'm not sure you may have known or may have heard, and that is that that allows individuals who otherwise meet the minimum qualifications to take an online exam and be eligible the minute they finish that exam. That is huge, because if that had not been in place, those of you who are here who are in civil service to conduct an exam, do the recruiting, conduct the exam, and do all that, that would have taken months and months and to find the candidates. This really streamlined and expedited our ability to bring qualified candidates to this pool. Orientation Center for the Blind. The stationary engineer, it's a position that's been vacant for many, many, many months. We've been recruiting and recruiting and recruiting, and I am happy to report, knock on wood, that by the beginning of June, we have made an offer. The person has accepted the offer, and we'll have a stationary engineer. And that is key to supporting the services at OCB. Little things we don't think about, like heat, water, toilets, okay? This person is key to making all that stuff go. So we are very, very happy to, and Warren has just, that guy has done remarkable stuff. A retired annuitant who's leading a $7 million upgrade and administering OCB and recruiting and managing everything else that goes with that kind of work. I mean, he just did a phenomenal job for us, so we're very ecstatic to report that. Student census. Tony talked about the renovation, and I can best describe it as a controlled war zone. And let me tell you, we had some internal discussions about the appropriateness of students returning, and Warren has just managed it just absolutely marvelous. We have 20 students on campus through this whole renovation. We have a waiting list of 13 students. And what's keeping us from processing those students is bed space, because some of the dorm rooms right now are being used as swing space, because we have to move out of our administration building. We have to move out of buildings. They go in, do their magic, and we move back. We move something else, go in and do this. So this, we're now going to be moving out of the administration building next week, I believe it is, Monday and Tuesday. And so we're hopeful that by the end of this renovation that the census will be at capacity. Our objective is to make sure that we have as many people as possible take advantage of the services there. Tony alluded to the curriculum being updated, and Warren, much of his credit and discussions that we had, recognized that not only do we need to renovate the physical infrastructure, but the program as well. And let me be very upfront with you here. Staff have begun that work, because we need to have and want to have community participation and the Blind Advisory Committee and other interested stakeholders, and making sure that that curriculum is what it should be. So this is a beginning, by no means the end. And I'm a firm believer the curriculum should never be in cement. We should be looking to improve and learn and improve and learn as we continue.
Joe, I want to say that part of that curriculum is Warren's leadership. It's partly Joe's, and it's partly all of yours. I know people in this room are looking at Brian who have been kind of a proponent that we need to really change things there, and we've looked at all of that and taken into consideration. So, but as Joe said, it's not going to be static. It'll be moving along.
Okay, thank you. Older individuals who are blind program. We submitted the federal fiscal year 2010 report. It got submitted. There were 17 agencies that have grants totaling some $3.4 million. 68 full-time equivalents supporting that program from our service providers. By the way, one of these little factoids I really love. In my age group, OIB served 23 individuals who are over 100. Okay? So kudos to those 23. Okay? We served 5,509 consumers in the federal fiscal year. Stimulus grants updates. We received about $3.4 million, I believe, went out to the community for the OIB grants. And while that was a blessing, it has proven to be an extraordinary challenge for the community to receive that much money and to do what they needed to do with it, with all of the requirements that come with public money. We have been working with the community, with our partners, to make sure that they fully expend those funds. And good progress has been made. Significant progress has been made. We still remain very vigilant and, frankly, somewhat concerned that we can. And it's no disrespect to any of our partners, because they are doing double time to make sure that they do that. But as I've shared with our Blind Advisory Committee and in other forums, we want to make sure that we're transparent in about what we're working with and what the issues are at hand. In August, and this is tentative because we have the executive order that is very much impeding our travel capacity, we are looking to put together our OIB community, there are 17 providers and some of their key staff, as well as our Blind Advisory Committee, for an educational and planning forum for OIB. A couple of the key things that need to be done there are, one, we've began the work to establish what are the service areas for OIB. Two, what are the methodology that will be used to fund each of those service areas? And then three, within those service areas, how will we distribute the funding? And again, this comes back to the question that I've been asking and continue to ask is, tell me what OIB looks like in 2020, 2030. Because answering that question decides what we do and how we do it. You got 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let me scroll through this. I'm scrolling. Blind Field Services. Let me talk real quickly about Blind Field Services. I started asking a very simple question. What do we need to do to get to 800 competitive closures? We are right now competitive. Round numbers, 350. Kudos to the 350. Kudos to the 1,004 closures that we've had overall. My question is, what do we need to do to get to 800? That question is not intended to become a production. That question is intended for us to look at the quality of what we do and the services that we provide, and what do we need to do to improve on those so that each year 800 blind and visually impaired Californians get competitive placement. Their wages are a third higher than the average wage for all of DOR placements each year. I think they should be higher than that. So right now they're about $600 a week average. I think we should have 800 competitive closures at $700 a week. And when we get to that, let's make it 1,200 and 800. Okay? So the whole point there, and so Kathy and her team and counselors that are here and supervisors that are here, there's a lot of focus and a lot of discussion on what do we need to do to get there. A little bit about the BEP. We have submitted the RSA 15 report. We've shared that with our community partners. We've shared that with the vendor community. As Tony said, you know, there's about $2+ million that went into BEP. We developed 9 new locations, and, you know, there's a software program that supports the BEP functions that we're looking to put into place to improve the accountability as well as improve the efficiencies and effectiveness of all of the work that we need to do within BEP. I hear Joni and Paul doing a dance over here in the corner, which is, so am I, because it's way overdue. How much time do I have, Donna?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Whew. One of the things that I have, one of the things, that, you know, of course, we're doing a lot of work with BEP. We've done a lot of work with establishing a vision for the program, and simply said, we believe it should be the preferred food service of choice.
Yeah.
We believe anybody who's looking for food service should be saying, Joe, what do we need to do to get BEP in our location? Deb, what do we need to do to get BEP into our building? When we reach that, the 6 arbitrations and the 6 court cases that we have going, Those change. That's the focus. Now, while we work to get there, we do have a lot of things that we're working on right now. And I'm here. I'll speak to RSVC tomorrow. Also, I'll be talking about some of those. I just want to share with you that, you know, I have probably another 4 pages of notes to go through, but in the interest of time, I'm going to abbreviate it a little bit. We've done a lot of things to look at specialized services and SB 105. We're looking at how do we improve services to the blind within blind field services. How do we improve BEP? You heard me talk about OIB. You heard the work that's going on at OCB. We are looking at our homemaker caseload, so we have a much better understanding of what that means. We've had a counselor forum where we have 9 counselors from throughout the state sit down and have a conversation with Kathy Bales and myself to hear firsthand what are they experiencing, what are they seeing. And we're taking that information, and within the resources and the time that we have, we're acting on that. We're working with the Blind Advisory Committee. We've had a couple of very, very good meetings since I've been here. Brian has been elected the chair of the committee. Kudos to Brian. I'm very much looking forward to working with him. But one of the things that I talked to Pete Benavides about, and Brian as well, is coming to the back to be proactive. Here's the problem we're facing. Help us solve it. Here's the policy we're thinking about. Help us make sure that this policy gets us to 800, gets us to the preferred food service of choice. There's a lot more that I will say, but I will hold my comments here, because otherwise Brian's going to rip the mic from my hand and start talking, and I don't want to wrestle him, Mike, right now. I'll wrestle him for a beer later, but not for the mic. So thank you, everybody. Thank you for having us here.
Okay, thank you very much. And All right. And again, in the interest of time, we're not able to take any questions at this point. But this has been a great presentation, and we thank both of you for coming. And I'm glad we were in Sacramento so that you could come as well. So thank you very much. From exploration to innovation, a practical approach in achieving career success. Richard Rueda, Director of Community Service, Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired in San Francisco, California. We know Richard. Give him a great hand. And we also have Kate Williams, program.
Donna, Kate is not with us today.
Oh, she's not. Okay. Okay. I'll go ahead and give the microphone over to Richard. I do have your bio, but Ed has informed me that you brought a large number of folks with you, and we have 15 minutes for you on the agenda, so I'm going to give you the floor. It's all yours, Richard.
Madam President and CCB members, thank you for the opportunity for us to be with you today. Richard Retha, Director of Community Services. Rapid fire, you're going to hear my Twitter speech in 15 minutes. You're going to hear from 5 people in 15 minutes. We're going to give you 2.5 hours worth of information in 15 minutes. So we have some really cool programs over the past year since I've been with the Lighthouse. Alina went to my right. We've created an awesome program that's addressing barriers to employment, that's putting people to work and jumping into the workforce and giving people work experiences. We're going to talk about our successes, our strengths, and you're going to hear from 2 of our current blind leaders, Anthony and Tommy themselves, and they're going to give you 30 seconds worth of valuable information. At the very end, the last half of the seven minutes remaining, Brian Bashan will speak to you about our employment immersion program. I'll leave you with this. Last year alone, we served 37 people, over 25% of them as a result of participating in the Work Adjustment Training Program as sponsored by the Department of Rehabilitation. As we call it, our Blind Leaders Program, have retained part-time and full-time employment. That's pretty impressive. Ladies and gentlemen, our Blind Leaders Program coordinator, Arlena Nguyen.
Thank you for having us today. So as Richard said, I am the Blind Leaders Program Coordinator at the Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And this program is a unique opportunity to cultivate and lead blind individuals who are seeking and transitioning into work and their career. The Blind Leaders Program was established this year in February of 2010. That was last year, actually. Actually stemmed from the BEPYUP program, which is the Business Enterprise and Youth Employment Program, which primarily allows transition age youth to work at BEPYUP, to work at BEP stands within the state. And so what the whole premise of the Blind Leaders Program was to extend the summer work experience to a year-round experience. And so as Richard said, last year we served 37 individuals. And that actually is a huge testament, because in 2009, the program at the Lighthouse had only served 13 individuals. So we almost tripled that number. And that has to do with the large dedication of our staff, as well as our new CEO, Brian Bashan, who has a vision to innovate and create opportunities. And so just basically, the Blind Leaders Program, as Richard mentioned, is a program designed to address barriers to employment, which have to do with interpersonal skills, organizational, time management, as well as intrinsic motivation. And one of the main barriers to employment that we've seen over the past year is an individual's confidence, their confidence in knowing that they can contribute to the workforce, and not only contribute, but actually get a job in the workforce. And that's pretty profound, because I was actually one of those individuals who didn't think that they could get a full-time job. So, you know, from the age of 17 to 29 years old, I traveled around. I got 2 degrees, one in finance, one in workplace psychology. I visited many countries, you know, around the world. I had a daughter, but yet I had only had a few part-time jobs. And it wasn't until the age of 30 that I first wrote my first resume. I wrote my first cover letter, and I was offered a full-time position at the Lighthouse for the Blind. And this position at the time was called the Transition Employment Coordinator position. Now it's the Blind Leaders Coordinator. But one of the great things that the Lighthouse was able to offer me was an opportunity to gain valuable work experience. And so that's why Richard Duetta and I, myself, our supporting staff, as well as Brian Bashan, have the vision to offer a program to individuals who would like supported, meaningful work experience. And so I'm just going to briefly wrap this up. And earlier, Tony was mentioning about case closures and successful placements and so on. And so, like I said, the whole premise of the Blind Leaders Program is to offer meaningful work experience. And I will actually be transitioning into the next phase of my employment. I was offered a job with the City Department of Public Health of San Francisco. So I will personally be transitioning into that position. And that's a really great testament to what this program was all about, because not only did I lead blind leaders into employment, but I also led myself amongst my staff with their assistance into the next phase in my life. So. And lastly, it was stated earlier that there were 350 case closures. Well, as of yesterday, there are 351 successful DOR case closures. So, I will now pass the microphone on to two of our current blind leaders, Tommy Lucier and Anthony Dolly. And we chose these individuals to speak briefly today on their experience, because it's really important for you to hear the personal testament from individuals in the program. So, Tommy?
Hi, I'm Tommy Lucier, and I'm currently a participant in the Blind Leaders Program. And more specifically, I'm involved in the planning and development of the Please Touch Community Garden. And that garden project is a major community arts project that was undertaken by the Lighthouse as part of this program and this job, breaking down the barriers to employment program. Sometimes I get my hands dirty in the garden, but more specifically, I am writing publicity and letters to prospective donors. And this project underscores the Lighthouse's dedication that people with all disabilities can and should create art spaces using the principles of universal design. And for myself, I have benefited from this program because it has reaffirmed to me the importance of collaboration and teamwork and flexibility. And I'm really excited about the Lighthouse's new opportunities for breaking down these barriers to employment. It's an exciting time, and it's also an exciting time for civil rights, too. And thank you very much.
Greetings. My name is Anthony Dolly, and I am currently also a blind leader in the Blind Leaders Enrichment Program. I work as I perform various duties such as reception work and basic spreadsheet accounting, and I'm also a consultant upstairs for the Braille department. I would say the major changes that I have made as a result of this program, I have, quote, broken down some barriers, like I've learned to work under stress, and I have also learned to work as part of a team. And I was also enlightened and exposed to many opportunities
So this is a perfect opportunity for our blind leaders to practice some public speaking. So, a room full of welcomed guests, we definitely appreciate that. And both of these individuals, if you want to give them a round of applause. And so we thank you. And Richard will now transition into Brian. Thank you.
And that's our Blind Leaders Program. You can contact us at the Lighthouse at 415-431-1481 to learn more about the program. And Arlena and I and the Blind Leaders will be here all weekend. Brian Bashian is going to speak for Kate Williams on our brand new Employment Immersion Program. Brian, take it away.
Thanks, Richard. Can you understand how much fun it is to create programs when you're working with people like Richard and Arlena? It's tremendous. You know, Richard, whose brain is on fire, who emails me at 1 o'clock in the morning on Sunday with ideas for new programs and new connections, and Arlena, who has practiced what she preached, advocated for herself, and as a result of the community contacts the Light has had with the City County of San Francisco, the largest employer there, we have now doubled the number of blind people who are working for the city and county, and we are proud about that. 3 hires in the last 8 weeks, and we're on our way to making the city of San Francisco look like San Francisco, which means 90 blind people working for the city. So we're on our way. Let me tell you, the Lighthouse actually has 4 programs that are employment-related. Our traditional NIB implant produces packets for meals ready to eat in our factory in Oakland. We have the Blind Leaders Program under Richard and Arlena's stewardship, doing great things. Very proud of that. I want to talk to you about the 2 latest programs, the Employment Immersion Program. And this one simply says, when you're ready to go to work, not when you're ready to start studying anthropology or maybe thinking about learning JAWS, but when you're really ready to pull the trigger on your employment and go for that brass ring, we work with you. And we work using a model that says, this program will be at your door no less frequently than every 72 hours. Meet several times a week. You have email, assignments, connections, and a whole team approach. And I look at it as a very complementary thing to the team approach that VRMod may be rolling out in the next few months across California. What does it mean with a team? Well, I'm here representing Kate Williams. She was a headhunter in private industry for 20 years, finding the right candidates for business. And she became blind herself a few years ago. She knows both sides of the story. So Kate is the coordinator of the program, and she's had tremendous success in connecting employers and job seekers. So the Employment Immersion Program is about one thing. It is about job seeking. It is about that verb. And so under Kate's direction, people who join the program spend 4 months in an intensive meet together. We were just there yesterday in Berkeley, 16 job seekers around a table talking passionately. We had a special guest, the Hornswoggle Director Tony Sauer, to come and speak to us. He gave up his lunch hour and he spoke for an hour about what is it like to be a person with a disability, questioning your confidence when you were a lot younger and sucking it up and working twice as hard and doing it through doubt and skepticism and prejudice. And he gave a tremendous, tremendous orientation to our job seekers. I just want to thank Tony Sauer for making the time available to us for that. So the job seekers meet multiple times, and we made sure that the traditional barriers are gone. There are accessible computers that people can use. If you need somebody to fax or need a pair of eyeballs to do something, that person is there. If you need some technical assistance applying to a website or whatever, that's there. We have taken all these common things off the table. And we've married the program with something very interesting too, which is life coaching. Life coaching is not therapy. It's not getting on the couch and talking about your mother or anything like that. It's more about what are you going to do on Tuesday? You said you were going to maybe apply for jobs. Well, how many do you think you can apply for on Tuesday? How many is that? And we'll talk about it because guess what? We're meeting on Tuesday. So it is an intense but supported way to get folks to do the things that you need. Applying for jobs, getting employed, it's a numbers game. They say it takes 70 or 80 applications for a sighted person in California to get a job. So the question is, when I used to work with job seekers directly, if you maybe got out one application a month and then maybe got one out the next month, are you really prepared to wait 7 years so you have a 50% probability to get a job? So this is really about encouraging, supporting, and making sure people are on track. Employment immersion. With the life coaching, every time we meet and we talk, it's a very new addition to it, and it is about action in your lives. And we've had several successes already in employment. This program is just a few months old. It's being funded by stimulus funding. Again, thank you to the Department of Rehabilitation for finding the creativity to think out of the box here. And we hope to find resources to make this program continue in the future. And the latest and the newest program that we're doing along employment is something we call Job Site Conversation Series. There are many people who are newly blind or have been blind a long time that have never met a blind person doing the job they think they want to do, or a job that they didn't know a blind person could do. We were at Enchanted Hills Camp 2 weeks ago with the Transition Youth Summit. We asked a number of the Transition Youth, what would you like to do? They had very many interesting ideas about what they'd like to do. And we asked them, do you know any blind people doing that job? And almost to a person, the answer was no. So we want to change that. And thanks to a grant from the Black Rock Foundation, we're able to take 25 trips. These trips will start in June. They're free. We'll feed you lunch. You'll come and you'll spend 5 hours with us. We will bus or BART to the job site of an employed blind person. We will talk to the blind person. We will talk to that person's supervisor. You'll get to ask questions. But we believe that once you see a blind person in action in their job site and have an earnest conversation about what are the problems, how'd you get this job, how do you keep this job, you cannot unscramble that egg. You will never be able to think about blind employment the same way. So 25 job visits for all comers from starting in June for the rest of the year. We'd love you to come and join us if you can possibly make it to the Bay Area. They'll be at Wednesday meetings starting in June. That's what I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming. And Richard, it'll be good to see you here all weekend. So thank you very much. Okay, the next item on our program is the accessibility of state parks. And we have Tim Gilbert, who will not be with us. He's a very kind man. He developed the flu and has decided not to share it with us. So he will not be here today. Jennifer Harris, Chief Accessibility Section, California State Parks, is here with us today. And we are running a little over, so no disrespect, Jennifer, but in the interest of time, I'd like to go ahead and allow you to begin your portion of the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you for inviting me to speak this afternoon at the Spring Conference. I'm very excited to be here today to share with you what California State Parks has been doing throughout the state park system to improve access for people with disabilities. I'd like to start out by giving you a little bit of background about State Parks Accessibility Section, then give you some information about specific park improvements that we've completed or are working on. Organized within acquisition and development, the accessibility section's mission is to provide direction, leadership, encouragement, and facilitation toward universal accessibility to maximize park visitor opportunities. Toward that end, the accessibility section and its staff work to ensure that universal accessibility is integrated into state parks culture and embodied in its programs, providing visitors, regardless of their abilities, with high-quality recreational opportunities while preserving the integrity of cultural, historical, and environmental resources. We do this by providing training to park staff, by performing accessibility reviews of major improvement projects and interpretive program elements, and by analyzing and assisting with the development of park policies and procedures. The majority of responsibilities within the accessibility section are focused around scoping, designing, and completing barrier removal projects and accessible trail projects throughout the state park system pursuant to the state's transition plan and the Tucker Consent Decree. By a show of hands, are there any folks here who are unfamiliar with the Tucker Consent Decree? Lots. Okay, so a little bit of background. In the late 1990s, State Parks was sued. It was a class action lawsuit because people with disabilities weren't provided with the same level of access as people without disabilities. For a number of years, State Parks staff worked with disability rights advocates and the California Council for the Blind to develop a consent decree, which outlines work that State Parks will do in the state park system to provide equal access. So my section is involved in implementing that consent decree. To date, State Parks has completed hundreds of barrier removal projects throughout the state park system at a cost of nearly $80 million. Generally speaking, we have three types of projects that we work on in the accessibility section. There are large projects that involve major renovations or construction of buildings, such as restrooms and visitor centers, or that require the relocation of sewer lines, roads, or septic systems. These large projects require extensive design and engineering to produce full construction documents. State Parks then bids out these projects as public works projects and follows the state contracting laws to do that. In general, these large projects cost between $1 and $2 million apiece. The second type of project is less complicated and is completed by the accessibility units to construction crews. We have a crew that's located up north that is housed out of Lake Natomas, and we have a crew that is housed down south that works out of Lake Paris. They travel extensively throughout the state Monday through Friday and are housed in hotels and focused really on improving our parks. Generally speaking, the accessibility construction crew projects range between $250,000 and $500,000. The third type of projects that we work on are trail projects. We have a landscape architect on staff that goes out to park units and walks the existing trails to determine which can be made accessible. And we're talking about accessible, we mean fully accessible to all users. The landscape architect designs the trails to comply with all federal outdoor regulations and guidelines. Sometimes we utilize state parks' own staff to work on the trails, but most frequently we use labor from the California Conservation Corps that we ourselves supervise. We have trail projects that range from $250,000 to $1 million. Every project in the state park system, regardless of type, undergoes an extensive review process to ensure compliance with California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, as well as historical and cultural guidelines and regulations. Many times, Native American monitors must be present when we disturb the ground, and similarly, environmental scientists must be present if we are working in an area with sensitive species or nesting birds. Very often, projects take up to 3 years to complete, from original scoping through construction. This is due to the required environmental reviews and other environmental issues such as weather and animal activity and park visitation. Certainly, the state's budget woes can and do impact us as well. When the budget is late, we cannot encumber funds to let a contract, we cannot send staff out to travel and work, and we cannot purchase required equipment and materials for a construction job. As part of the consent decree, we have what's called the transition plan, and that is actually the document that details the parks and the activities that we're going to make accessible. The work plan to the transition plan are specific line items. For example, at Mount Diablo State Park, we are currently in design to make camping, picnicking, and the visitor center at the top of the mountain accessible. We are also designing an accessible trail. The specific work items include constructing accessible campsites, modifying restrooms, creating accessible parking and routes, installing accessible picnic sites, and modifying exhibits for clear space and visual elements. It is likely that the projects at Mount Diablo will take up to 4 years to complete because of significant environmental issues regarding the Alameda whip snake, an endangered species. Personally, I don't care about snakes.
Don't like them.
There aren't any environmentalists in here, right? Semi-annually, State Parks reports on the work it has performed. The reports include listings of new and completed projects and updates to ongoing projects. MIG, the court-appointed monitoring firm, selects 10% of completed projects from our reports and performs on-site reviews to ensure it complies with accessibility standards and building codes. MIG's latest report was given to us in December 2010, and their review was performed at Hearst Castle. The Hearst Castle was a multi-year project that cost $1.5 million. In the report dated December 2010, MIG stated the following as its overall observation. Begin quotes. MIG confirmed that the description of accessibility features outlined on State Park's website was accurate and all features outlined were available to the public. Additional, overall accessibility improvements were observed at the visitor center. MIG was particularly impressed with the passenger loading zone and exiting conditions provided at the tour commencement. This design enabled all visitors to queue for tours in the same area. Also, drivers were helpful in answering questions related to accessibility and tour options. Also, as part of its report, MIG found just a couple of minor deviations. And again, this was a very, very large project, and their observations were that we had a non-compliant latch on one restroom and a non-self-closing door on another restroom. These are very minor things that we fixed very quickly. For a listing of all work that we've completed in the state park system, you can visit State Park's website at www.parks.ca.gov and navigate to the accessibility page, and on the left sidebar, navigate to completed projects. As identified in the semi-annual reports, State Parks has made excellent progress on burial removal projects, but at this time is behind schedule. Projects have taken much longer and have cost significantly more than I believe the authors to the consent decree anticipated. Again, we've got significant design and engineering processes and environmental and budget issues that we deal with daily. For example, a massive wildfire in the Arroyo Seco area at Cuyamaca Rancho State Park in Riverside County burned nearly 25,000 acres of parkland and destroyed park structures, campgrounds, and day use areas. Subsequently, trees that survived the fire have succumbed to drought and disease, and much of the park remains closed to visitors. Ongoing efforts to clean up and reestablish the park have been hampered by cultural and environmental issues, and therefore State Parks revised the burial removal work that was originally identified in the transition plan, and we are just now in design in another area of the park. At Pfeiffer Big Sur State Park, state parks received legislative approval for a major capital outlay project that will remedy almost all of the transition plan items and provide accessibility to visitors. Unfortunately, the project ran into some complications. First, the state's cash shortfall caused the project to stop, and then we had to fire the contractor for poor work quality. Right now, we're rebidding the project. When Gene Lozano asked me to speak, he asked for some specific information about work we've done at Angel Island State Park and the California State Railroad Museum. Angel Island State Park is designated Level 2 per the transition plan and the consent decree. A little bit of background, what we did was we surveyed all the park units in the state park system and we prioritized them Level 1, 2, 3, or 4, Level 1 being the highest, the ones that needed to be completed first, and Level 4, lowest, we'll complete those last. So Angel Island is Level 2. According to the consent decree, the major activities to be made programmatically accessible on Angel Island include the exhibits and interpretive programs, hiking, picnicking, and the Visitor Center Museum. The transition plan identified 8 specific line items for barrier removal, which consist of modifications to restrooms, the Visitor Center, and the picnic area located in Ayala Cove. As of today, 2 restroom facilities in Ayala Cove have been made fully accessible, and an accessible trail project has been designed. The trail project is currently being evaluated for compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act. Projects to remove barriers to picnicking and to provide compliant access to the visitor center are currently in the design phase and are expected to commence in the 2011-12 fiscal year. Persons familiar with Angel Island State Park may be aware of the recently renovated immigration station located in the North Garrison area. This area is not specifically mentioned in the transition plan because at the time we surveyed Angel Island, there was very little open to the public. However, recent improvements around the immigration station incorporate full accessibility to the detention barracks, including an elevator to the second floor, compliant routes of travel throughout the grounds with accessible interpretive panels, a tactile relief map, and touchable artifact replicas. Staff and trained volunteers are nearly always present to provide guided tours and to describe and interpret visual elements. One of the biggest draws to the immigration station are the Chinese poems carved into the walls of the detention barracks. While no visitor is allowed to touch the walls, a full-size replica of a wall with carvings is available for all to touch. In addition, there are audio features that allow visitors to listen to the poems in either Chinese and English. Further, the park has translated some of the programs into Braille. The California State Railroad Museum is considered part of Old Town Sacramento State Historic Park and is also designated Level 2. At the Railroad Museum, we are working to provide programmatic access to the Visitor Center and Museum and exhibits and interpretive programs. There are 14 line items that address barrier removal in and around the museum, including exhibit upgrades, modifications to the train depot, restrooms, and routes of travel. At this time, we have not scheduled the work, but the park itself has removed various barriers to access as part of its own independent district-led projects and routine maintenance activities. Scores of well-trained docents are available to provide individual interpretation of museum elements, and individuals may check out listening devices, audio describe several of the museum's interpretive features. The museum also has a scaled model of the cab forward train so that visitors can grasp the enormity of this very, very large train. The museum has also begun utilizing QR codes, which smartphones can read. I was unfamiliar with QR codes. Do any of you know what these are? Yeah, there's these little barcodes, and I suppose we take a picture of it somehow, and then you can send it to some sort of program that you have, and then it will read it to you. So it's just another option. State Parks has done some other improvements to improve access for people who are blind or have visual impairments. Currently, the consent decree requires that videos be captioned. Although not required, the accessibility section has begun coordinating with its interpretation and education division to request that new videos also become audio described. We found that getting involved early on, the videos can be audio described very well, whereas if you wait till the end, it doesn't work so well. The accessibility section has also closely with museum and interpretation staff and made it a priority to incorporate elements for people with sensory disabilities during the design of new and upgraded exhibits. Recently, I visited the Leland Stanford Museum and was impressed with the tactile displays as well as the videos. I was told that staff consulted with the Sacramento Society for the Blind on designing key design elements. The outcome is that panels are consistent in the presentation of ideas, the touch screens are consistent with regard to placement of icons, and the panels have raised lettering. The highlight, I believe, was a scaled model that was created that depicts the mansion and can be taken apart piece by piece so that one can really see how the various additions to the mansion were developed. One of the things I am the most excited about that we're doing right now are audio-described trails. This is something new, a pilot project, if you will, that we've done at Mount San Jacinto State Park and at China Camp State Park. Already, our accessible trails have many features that improve access for people who are blind or have low vision. More specifically, our trails are free of major trail tread obstacles. Guidelines allow for up to 2-inch tall protrusions in the trail tread for non-paved surfaces and 1/2 inch for concrete, asphalt, and board surfaces. The trails are free of protruding objects within a 36-inch wide and an 80-inch high trail corridor. There are reduced openings in the trail surface no greater than 1/2 inch, for example, on boardwalks. And there are detectable edges such as curbing, railing, rope guides, and chains in surface texture for safe trail navigation. What's new at both Mount San Jacinto and China Camp are audio components, tactile interpretive panels, and detectable surface textures to indicate where the panels are and where benches are along the trails. At Mount San Jacinto, we have a trail called the Panorama Point Trail, and at China Camp, it's called the Turtleback Trail. We developed these trails with tactile displays and fully audio describe them. In addition, at each panel, the surface changes to identify the presence of an interpretive. You can log on to State Park's website and visit these parks and download audio clips that play while you enjoy the trail. And I found that even if you weren't proactive, you could navigate with a smartphone right there in the park and play the clip right off the internet. At the end of the clips, we ask users to share their thoughts with State Parks, but to date, we haven't received any comments. If you do get the chance to visit either of these trails and utilize the audio clips, we would love to hear from you. At this time, I'd like to play for you a couple of the clips and give you an idea of what I'm talking about. The first clip is just an introduction about the video or the audio clip.
Introduction. Welcome to Mount San Jacinto State Park's Panorama Point Trail. This is a 1 mile long accessible trail with informational or interpretive panels. Its trailhead is located in the Stone Creek Campground. Two accessible parking spaces are adjacent to the trailhead, opposite campsite 14. California State Parks designed the trail for persons with little or no vision and for all who enjoy learning by touch. The interpretive panels include 3 with touchable or tactile elements. Boards set evenly into the trail surface mark the locations of the panels and of 2 trailside benches. Although some hikers who are blind or have low vision may manage fully independent navigation of this trail, we recommend traveling with a sighted person. We encourage you to hike the whole trail, including the short spur to the point, and then complete the rest of the loop back to the start. Are you ready to head over to the trailhead and get started?
Play the next one. And since Tim's not here, we can play more.
The trail begins with a slight rise. A bench is located just beyond the start of the trail on the left side next to an orientation panel. When you encounter the wood boards across the trail surface, you're at the bench. You might like to sit down for a moment and get oriented. The trail is shaped roughly like a crescent. You are entering near the center of its outer curve. About 1/2 mile in, a short spur trail curls off the main trail. The spur leads to a stunning panoramic view, tactily interpreted on a large topographic panel. 5 panels, 3 with touch elements, follow the orientation panel summarized here. All panels have audio description. The audio description gives the panel information in the order panels are found and tells you on which side of the trail each panel is located. Panels are mounted at an angle with lower edge roughly hip high and the tactile elements along the panel's right side. The exception is the topographic map. It is mounted vertically on a short wall, and nearly the entire panel is tactile. The trail is about 4 feet wide on compacted soil. You'll occasionally cross inset stone drainage elements that may be slippery when wet. Elevation gains and losses total about 100 feet each, and the average slope is 6%. Only pedestrians and dogs on leash are allowed. No water or restrooms are available.
And I'm going to play you just one of the panels. This is panel three.
Panel three, two prominent pines, audio only. Two record-holding tree species, the colder pine and the sugar pine, grow along this trail. Their cones help identify them. Please remember to put back any cones you explore. Colder pine cones are the heaviest in the world, typically weighing about 5 pounds. The heaviest cone recorded was 8 pounds. They are also called big cone pines and widow makers. Sugar pines are the tallest pines in the Americas and have the longest cones. Some cones reach lengths of more than 2 feet. No matter their size, the elongated sausage-like shape will help you spot sugar pine cones on this trail. Native Californians ate the large, sweet seeds.
I really do hope that you're able to get out to some of these parks and check out the trails and listen to the audio components. I did it with the component listening, and it was certainly a different experience. Many of our trails don't have interpretive elements, but I've directed staff that when there are interpretive features, that they all must be audio described. I did meet earlier with Gene Lozano and Jeff Tom, and part of the reason I think that folks don't know about this is that we didn't really have any press on it. So we'll be working together to get information out to people who are blind or have low vision on the latest features in our state parks. At this time, I welcome any questions or comments you have with regard to the state park system and our accessible features. We really want to use our dollars in the best way possible and want to do what's best for you out there.
So if anyone has any questions, if you could please raise your hand. And Ed is going around with a roving mic.
Lisa Gordon, I have a comment on the first panel that you played. I thought they were all really great. I thought all the panels were really great. I don't know about the part about saying that you should navigate this trail with a sighted person. Came off as just a little condescending to me. But I'm sure, I mean, I don't know that I would be brave enough to do it by myself, but it's a little condescending. I mean, I think if you have those issues, you probably already know that about yourself and don't really need to be told that you should be with a sighted person.
Do you think perhaps it would be better if we said travel with a or maybe qualify? Because I know, for example, at Mount San Jacinto, there are mountain lions and bears and other things. Just as a safety precaution.
Well, I don't know if you were with a sighted person, I don't know if you'd be that much safer. Anyway, I mean, they'd have a problem too.
Depends on how fast you could run, or
yeah,
you only have to run faster than your friend.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's better to describe some of the hazards and then let people make their own decisions.
Okay, thank you.
Well, the sighted person has a gun.
Can't bring firearms into state parks.
No firearms. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, raise those
hands. This is Shirley Manning. Back to the companion hiking, it might be better just simply to say that wisdom says you should not hike alone no matter.
Oh, well, thank you.
That's great.
Yes, thank you.
I have four more hands.
Okay.
This is Diane Deutsch. Have you developed anything at John Muir Park?
Not yet. And I don't have the transition plan with me, but you can go to Disability Rights Advocates website, and they do have the full transition plan on their website, and you can look and identify the specific work that we will be doing there. And that's www.dralegal.org. Thank you, Larry.
Sam Chen from Silicon Valley. The question is, you know, I'm interested in hiking, and are there volunteers or, you know, some of the people there who can escort us, you know, initially so we can be become familiar with the trail, even though I know that, you know, the ropes or in those, you know, audio signals are there. But I think someone to escort us, you know, at the beginning would be very, you know, preferred. Thank you.
I do know that at most state parks, the state park staff are very helpful. And if you were to go to the kiosk or the visitor center and ask someone to direct you and even take you to the trailhead, they would certainly do that. And probably with prior advance notice, they would walk the trail with you.
My question is related to Sam's kind of. I remember years ago hearing about the beginning of this case and all, and my reaction was my biggest accessibility problem with state parks heading to them. And I guess I wonder if there's any kind of way that blind people who don't come equipped with sighted families or something can ever hope to visit these places.
At this time, State Parks doesn't have any services to bring people to parks. I do know that we occasionally have groups that come in vans and that get dropped off, but that's not something that State Parks arranges. It's other groups that do that.
Jennifer? The Stanford Home here in town, did I hear that there was Braille with the radiant?
No, it's just raised lettering. And as we discussed earlier today, and the whole idea of some folks read Braille, many folks don't read Braille, but like we discussed, that's a kind of an immersion program, mm-hmm. And so we would in the future like maybe to discuss with you on the design.
Okay, thank you.
But at any time, the interpretive features can be described, and if you request, State Parks will provide the information in large font or Braille. It's not instantaneous. We don't keep copies of everything on, but we can provide that to you.
Hi, this is Cindy Aguilar, and I have a question. If I go to the State Parks website and do a search on the parks that have accessibility for visually impaired or blind, would those park names come up as a search list?
Right now, the website doesn't identify parks by disability type. All the work that we're doing has to comply with federal outdoor regulations, building codes, and the ADA, which provide universal accessibility. What the website does provide is you can do a search for accessible features of hiking. So it will identify camps or parks that have accessible trails. And all of our trails have the same standards of 36 inches wide, an 80-inch corridor that's tall, free of obstacles, curbs and edging, that sort of thing. You're welcome.
Yes, my name is Robert Wendt. The question I have, you mentioned earlier, Disability Rights Legal. What was the website again? And
sure.
Is the entire report for the whole state there?
Yes. What's on their website is the transition plan and the work plan and the consent decree itself. There's quite a lot of information. And again, that is www.dralegal.org. So dralegal.org. Yes. And our website has more information about park-specific things, but DRA was the attorneys for the class action lawsuit and have done a great job keeping all that information up to date.
Oh, hi, my Tim Ford. If you want to contact a particular park in advance to inquire, say, as to getting some assistance or to make better use of the accessibility features, what's the recommended way to contact that individual park?
Every park has a phone number listed on its website, and on the websites are also listed the accessibility section's hotline. And so I would recommend trying both ways with staff reductions in state parks and state park closure lists. Sometimes the parks aren't answering their phones, but we always have someone manning the phone, and if not, we do check our messages. You can also send emails through the through our website directly to my section.
I see no other hands.
Okay. Thank you very, very much for coming today. Okay. We have improving educational services for students with visual impairments through effective program guidelines, Dr. Linda Wyatt, Consultant, Special Education Division, California Department of Education, Sacramento, California. And one moment. Dr. Linda Wyatt is in her 42nd year of education in California. She began teaching in 1968 and taught for over 28 years before joining the Department of Education as a consultant. She is currently a consultant in the Special Education Division of CDE. The majority of years that she taught were with students with visual impairments as a resource teacher and then as an itinerant teacher. Linda holds two master's degrees and a doctorate in special education. As part of her work with CDE, she oversees funding for programs that serve students with low incidence disabilities, which includes blind and visually impaired programs. It is in this role that she has had the work over the last several months of updating the program guidelines for students with visual impairments. Please welcome Dr. Linda Wyatt.
Thank you. And let me say to you what a grand opportunity it is to be invited here to speak to you. I'm really pleased to be here. And also tell you what a wonderful audience I think you are. You've been sitting quietly for hours and doing a beautiful job. And my way of saying thank you for doing that is to be brief with my presentation. So I am going to be brief. Let me just tell you that when I started working with the Department of Education a little over 13 years ago, I held a position working as a consultant, as I do now, in special education. But then I worked in the field of transition, which, of course, is mandated by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And at that time, another consultant was working full-time in the area of education of students with visual impairments. That was his full-time job. Over the 14 years, that has slowly evolved to the point now where it is a very small. I came into that job about 3.5 years ago, and it has now evolved into very little of my time. In other words, many, many other jobs have been added to my plate, and nothing has been taken away. But it means that I have a lot less time to deal with issues related to students with visual impairments. In special education, we deal with students, we deal with infants to age 22 if they have an IEP, an individual educational program. They can stay, if they choose, they can stay in education in the K-12 system until 22 unless they get a diploma. If they get a diploma, that means they're done. That's it. And of course, none of the rest, they wouldn't want to stay anyway. So, but if they don't get a diploma and choose to, they can stay until their 22nd birthday. And there are three main responsibilities that I have in terms of working with students with visual impairments. One of those is to provide technical assistance to individuals who call me on the phone and ask specific questions about programs, educational programs related to students in the K-12 system. Those may be parents, administrators. And I've never had a student call me, but again, a lot of educators call, a lot of administrators call, and we provide guidance in that area. And the other piece that I do is deal with funding for low-incidence programs. And again, as she said, low-incidence programs are those for students who are blind, students who are deaf, students and students who are severely orthopedically impaired. Each year, the state budget provides funding for our department to disperse to CELPAs. CELPAs are our regional areas in California, and we provide the funding based on a formula of the number of students with low-incidence disabilities that they report to us each year. In the area of specialized equipment, materials, and books, we get a little over $13 million. In the area of specialized services, we get a little over $1.7 million. And each year, again, we distribute those based on a formula of the number of students with those low-incidence disabilities. So every district or every CELPA gets a certain amount of money. There's only one CELPA, and it's a very, very small rural area way up north somewhere. I don't even remember now which one it is, to tell you the truth, that did not report any students with low-incidence disabilities. But all of the other CELPAs get money. That means the districts that are within that CELPA get money. So if you hear from parents or you're a parent yourself of a student with a visual impairment and a district says, we don't have any money to purchase assistive technology or to provide that specialized service or to buy that book, you need to go back to them and say, what about your low-incidence funding? What are you doing with that? And how can we get some of that for this piece of equipment or this book or this specialized service? Because they all get some. For specialized services, $1.7 million doesn't truly go very far. It turns out to be 20-some-odd dollars per student, which is not a lot of money. But for specialized equipment, books, and materials, there's quite a bit more. That doesn't mean, by the way, that if a district has seven students, they get the money per student. That means that they have to demonstrate that there is a need for that piece of equipment as determined by an IEP team. An IEP team meets together to make the initial decision in the first place about whether a student qualifies for special education, and then it is also that IEP team that makes a decision about whether that piece of equipment or that specialized service is needed. And one of the requirements in the guidelines about low-incidence funding is that the student must have an IEP, and that that piece of equipment or that supply service or that book needs to be written into the IEP. So if you're attending an IEP as an advocate or as a parent, get as much detail into that IEP as you can so that if there is an issue, you can go back and say, wait a minute, you know, the IEP team made this decision. Here it is right here, and we need to be doing it, and we need to be doing it in a timely fashion. A lot of the complaints that I hear are about the fact that, yes, it's written in the IEP, but it's been months and nothing has happened. What can I do? Well, you or anybody else in the state of California can file a complaint about the education that a student with a disability is receiving in special education by calling our parent helpline. And I don't have that number memorized, but you can get it by going to the Department of Education's website at www.cde.ca.gov. And you can get the parent helpline number and call that number and make your claim. You don't have to be a parent. You don't have to be related to the student. And it may be something that you see as systemic, that you can't put your finger on the name of a student, but you see as a systemic issue, you can still file that complaint. So I would encourage you to do that if you see issues that are happening. The third thing that I deal with that is really why I'm here to talk to you about, and again, only briefly, is to tell you that one of my responsibilities is to provide oversight of what are called the low incidence guidelines. in ed code, in the education code that we must follow in California, it is mandated that we develop the guidelines. I'm going to actually read you the law of what it says. It's fairly brief. It says, the superintendent shall develop guidelines for each low incidence disability area and provide technical assistance to parents, teachers, and administrators regarding the implementation of the guidelines. The guidelines shall clarify the identification, assessment, planning of, and the provision of specialized services to pupils with low incidence disabilities. The superintendent shall consider guidelines when monitoring programs serving pupils with low incidence disabilities, and the adopted guidelines shall be promulgated for the purpose of establishing recommended guidelines and shall, this is the kicker here though, you have to hear this, and shall not operate to impose minimum state requirements. In California, we are what is called a local control state as far as education is concerned. That means that each school district has its own school board, unless it's been taken over by the state because it has been deemed financially, I want to use the word incompetent because that's what it is, but they don't have the money to operate. Then they're taken over by the state, and they have somebody who deals with them rather than the state or local board. But we are a local control district, which means that we can go to a district and say, this is what we would recommend you do, this is best practice, but they don't have to listen to us unless we can actually point to some place in the ed code or in IDEA that says specifically, you shall do this. Now, this again tells us, the State Department of Education, that we must develop the guidelines, implement the guidelines and provide technical assistance on them. And that's my job. And that's what I'm currently working on right now. The last time the guidelines were updated was back in 1997. That's a long time ago because a lot of stuff have happened since then. The reading and math braille standards have been put in place. The IDEA was reauthorized back in 2004 and, by the way, is coming up for reauthorization again probably within the next year or so. And if IDEA is reauthorized and you hear about any hearings, it is your opportunity to go to those hearings and give input into the education that is being developed for students with disabilities. So take advantage of that opportunity and go to those hearings. And again, I think that's going to happen within the next year or so, hopefully. Let's hold off on questions until we get to the end, and then I'll answer any questions that you have. The process that I use to make the decision, I looked at the guidelines and decided, hey, these are way past time to be updated. And already the CDE had used their wisdom in the tech support division to take them off of the website because they were so outdated. So I decided, yes, it is time for us to do this update. So I came with a process of how we would do it. And I want you to know this is one of the most important things you need to know, and that is that you had a voice in that update. We had two meetings, one in Riverside by a committee and one in Fremont at the School for the Blind by a committee. Each one of those committees, both of those committees, had a member of your organization present to give input. We also invited a representative from the National Federation of the Blind to be there. We had parents on the committee. We had a teacher of the visually impaired. We had a paraprofessional that works with students with visual impairments. And we had professors. In Riverside, we had a professor from Cal State LA, and in Fremont, we had a professor from San Francisco State. Why did we have those professors? Because at both of those universities, they offer the teaching credential that allows an individual to teach in the area of the visually impaired. And that's why we invited those professors to be on that committee. We had those committee meetings. We had a facilitator that took a lot of notes. We again met in December. You have to understand, first of all, that we didn't have much money. I'm crying the same that all of the other people that have been here from other state agencies of Christ, there aren't many resources. And we had very little money, but we did have enough money to pay for these individuals on the committee to come together. We paid their travel. And so, but in terms of having money to hire writers and so forth, we don't have much of that. So I will be leading the work. Now that we've taken the input from everybody on the committees, and I've encouraged others like you to, you know, if you feel there's some pressing thing about the education of students with visual impairments that you want me to know about to be considered for the guidelines, please email me and let me know that, because we have not started doing the final writing yet. My email address is lwyatt@cde.ca.gov. And I've received some emails from individuals who are saying, I have this real burning thing about this particular aspect of education of students with visual impairments that I want you to know about. Would you consider it for placement in the guidelines? So some of the things that came out in the two committee meetings that we held before we met in December had to do with changes in the role of the teacher of the visually impaired, now called the TVI. I'm going to refer to that person as the TVI. The role over the years has changed for TI because actually areas of blindness have changed. You know, some things have been dealt with medically, so they're not as big of an issue. New medical diagnoses have come forward and are more of an issue now. And TVIs have to look at these issues as they work with students that are visually impaired. So the student population and their needs have changed. The TVI's role has changed. One of the big reasons why the TVI's role has changed has to do with caseload. In our current guidelines, we recommend that in a resource room that a TVI have not more than maybe 12 students. I'm hearing, and let me say now, too, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that across the state of California, there are few, very few resource rooms left. Most of the programs are itinerant, which, you know, means that the teacher goes to the student. That has to do with mainstreaming. The student can attend their home school, and the TVI or the paraprofessional can go to the student rather than the student being bused to the resource room. And so I'm hearing about caseload sizes of 40 and 50 students. As you are aware, that currently is greater than a classroom teacher who may have only 30 or 32 students in the classroom. So what has happened is the TVI is spending more time seeing instructional assistants and paraprofessionals who are actually providing a lot of the direct service to the students. So they're overseeing the instructional assistants more than they're working directly with the students. Well, that can be problematic when you have a student who needs to learn Braille and the TVI doesn't have a lot of time to give to that student. So, but again, Ed Code, that is the law, does not dictate case size for any area of disability. The area that it does dictate caseload size is what is called the resource specialist room, the recess specialist program, 28 students. That's the only one that's addressed. None of the other disabilities have a caseload size addressed with it. That, as an organization, you may want to think about. I'm not suggesting that you do anything about it. I'm just saying you may want to think about it. So that is something for you to decide. But in our guidelines, again, we have specific numbers that if your program does this, we would recommend these numbers. And when I get phone calls from TVIs, they're saying, you know, I have a caseload of 40. Please help me. Call my district and tell them I can only have 12 students. And what I say to that TVI is, I can call your district. And I will say to the administrator, our guidelines recommend 12. And very often what I get back from the administrator is, but you cannot point to the law that says we can only have 12 students in that classroom for that TVI. And that's true, it doesn't. But I continue on my spiel about recommendations and best practices, and we've come up with these numbers based on best practices because of research that shows that an education is best when there's a low student population and da 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 da. So these are the things that we face as we look at the guidelines. So it was the role of the TVI that we're going to look at again and try to strengthen the language in the new guidelines. The other area that is not even addressed in the guidelines that we're going to have a section on now has to do with what some of you may know. It's called the expanded curriculum. The expanded core curriculum not only looks at academics, reading, writing, and arithmetic, it looks at living skills, personal skills, social skills, mobility, orientation. In other words, it is a holistic approach to an education for a student that is heard. It doesn't just look at the academics. And we're going to include that in the new guidelines, a whole section on that. I always have to be the bad guy that comes up with a however. However, we again cannot mandate that. We can recommend it. And I already know the spiel I'm going to get from administrators is, but how do we have enough hours in the day to do all of this? We're now looking at standardized testing. We're spending a lot of time on that. Tell me how we can have enough time to do this. And I'm going to put this back on you in the audience. I'm going to say to you, I would love for all of you to go back to your communities. And if you are not currently on your CAC, your Community Advisory Committee, I would love for you to go back to your Community Advisory Committee and say, I want to sign up, be a part of this, and bring education of students with visual impairments to the forefront. Because I can assure you, because numbers are not as great as in the area of, let's say, specific learning disabilities are in the area of behavior issues, emotional disturbances, often they're put on the back burner because, again, resources are limited. So go back to your community and ask how you can sign up to be on your community advisory committee and put it to the forefront. Talk about it. Talk about the caseload sizes that your TVIs are having to face, because I can tell you they're quitting in droves. And they're retiring, getting close to retirement, could stay on two or three more years and deciding this isn't worth it, I'm not going to do this anymore. And they're retiring. So that's another big issue in California we're facing, is we have low numbers of TVIs for the numbers that we need because of retirements. And so that means that maybe two or three districts are having to go together and share a TVI. So we're going to try and address some of that in the in guidelines, and provide some best practices about that. And also in the guidelines, something that is included but we're going to shore up again has to do with the various options of resource room, itinerant program, special day class, and give more clarity to what those are, in the hope that some districts will reconsider the need of perhaps having a resource room, not mandating it, but again, if a student is determined to need that, that would be available. Because IDEA is very clear that we have to provide a continuum of service. We do not make one size fits all. And that's, I'm afraid, where we're heading. And so we want to shore up that language. And by the way, one of the other things I want to say to you, and I want to say it now, even though it breaks into this, just because it's really important, I think, as you know, there is dire cuts that have come to education, and more may come. What does that mean for students that have disabilities, and particularly for you that are focused on students with visual impairments? What does that mean for them? That means that when I'm a teacher and I have 40 students in my classroom because the budget issues, how much attention can I give a student that is visually impaired when they're not seeing a TVI very often, and they may not have access very often to a paraprofessional? I have 40 students that I have to deal with. I'm going to have to think about the time that I give each one of them, and it has to be fair to all. So don't think that the cuts that are coming to education won't affect students that are visually impaired or students that are hard of hearing and in a deaf program. It will, because when they're mainstreamed, that's going to be severely impacted when classes become so large. And when I'm telling you, teachers are becoming discouraged. I'm thinking back to my years of teaching and thinking, you know, if teachers were being talked about as the way they are right now, I'd really have second thoughts about becoming a teacher. I'm not sure that would be something I would want to do. And so young people, and I know this to be a fact because I teach at two universities on the side, and there are less and less young people coming into the field of education because of the cuts that are coming and the responsibilities that are being placed on teachers without the time to do it. So go back to your school districts, your communities, and get involved. That is my challenge to you. Okay, having said all that, I want to answer some of your questions rather than me assuming I know what you want to know.
Okay, so if anyone has any questions, please put your hands up. Ed is going around with the mic. We have our first question.
This is Joni Patchy. One of the things I would like to ask you is how are you distributing this new guidelines to the parents? I feel that there's a great... parents are that there'd be a great interest in making some more resource rooms so that more kids could be served, but parents are reluctant to put the kids in a resource room because they think it's more normal to be in the classroom regardless of their education. Parents don't get it. I've talked to countless parents that, well, my kid's in regular education, but he can't read yet. He's only 12. He'll get to read soon, but it's sad. Mm-hmm. But how can we get the parents to understand these guidelines, and how can we disseminate them to them?
Well, you'll notice that in the law, it says that not only we will develop guidelines, but we'll distribute them. And we are going to do, we're not going to have any hard copies of the guidelines. They will be on the website, on the CDE website. But that means that you can go on the website and you can get them there and print out a copy of your own if you want to. But once we complete the guidelines, which my hope is, and I say this often, but my hope is that by the end of this year, they're up on the website. Because what I have to do is, once we're finished writing them, it's not done yet. Then we have to send them to our legal office, who then tells me whether I've overstepped my boundaries or not. And then it has to go to what is called the CDE Press to make sure that they meet all of the requirements of our website implementation. So my hope, though, is that they're up by the end of December. And we then are going to go across the state and do some trainings. We do those trainings through webinars and through video conferencing because we too are strapped for money. But we are required in the same law to do some training on the guidelines, and we will be doing that once they're up on the website.
Well, can we help? Is there any way we can help?
You mean as a parent group? Not yet, but there may be some times. You know, CDE funds parent empowerment centers, and we've engaged a couple of those centers to help us. And so down the road, we may need more of some that's kind of help. But I know where Jean Lozano lives and works. And so anytime I need your help, I get right on the phone, and I tell him, Gene, I need help. Yep. And he's always there. So I will do that again when I need you.
I just want to mention a couple of gaps that I think I detected. One is, where is the California School for the Blind in all this? And the other is, I don't believe I heard the word Braille once in your presentation.
The Braille and reading, or the reading and math Braille standards, will be included in the guidelines. And the School for the Blind has its very own section. There is a section already in there that is dedicated to the School for the Blind, and Sharon Sachs from the School for the Blind is working on updating that section. So they will be included, as will, again, the Braille and reading standards.
Hi, I'm Valerie Reese-Lerman, and I was educated in a resource room. And I want to tell you I've been very successful. I've been a reader advisor at the California State Library, Braille and Talking Book Library, over 25 years now. But I started from a very humble beginning, from a very dysfunctional family. And I want to tell you that it was the resource room that really saved me. I can't imagine how kids do it in regular classrooms.
They don't get any.
Being legally blind. I think it's a real, real injustice to people that are low vision or visually impaired. I just want to say that. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just speak here from a personal note. This is not CDE talking, but it's Linda Wyatt personal talking. As I told you, I did both resource and itinerant. I loved resource. I really had questions about itinerant. I didn't like traveling because I was tired. I mean, I gave my all when I got to the student, but when I taught in the Kern High School District in Bakersfield, I traveled 125 miles before I got to Ridgecrest. I was tired. There are some issues there. And I don't know what the answer is at this point in time. But I did love doing resource.
Hello, my name's Foster Brown. The past couple of years before I got the current job that I have, I worked as a paraprofessional for Riverside County Office of Education. You might be familiar with them. And one of the things that a lot of parents don't realize, and I'm pretty sure it happens with the parents of visually impaired or blind children, is that if your child is in a class like that, it is your right when you go for an IEP to ask for a one-on-one to work with your child. Now, you may not always get it due to budget or money, but it is your right as a parent to ask for a one-on-one, and that teacher will give specific instructions to work all day with that student. Another issue with being a paraprofessional, too, is that not all paraprofessionals especially are trained to work with visually impaired or blind students. I noticed they did have people that worked with deaf students that did fine, but as far as visually impaired, there's no real training for the paraprofessional to work with a blind or visually impaired student. So that's something that we need to push for within the state to help people of our population.
And I would say you bring up an excellent point. And one thing that I want to say, he is absolutely right that you do have the option of asking for a one-on-one aid. But let me tell you, you need to have a strong basis for which you make that, you want that to happen. You need to think very carefully and be able to articulate in an IEP why you feel your child needs a one-on-one aid. And in terms of talking about paraprofessionals, I've been getting phone calls recently from individuals who are Brailleless, who are paraprofessionals in districts that are losing their jobs because they don't have the seniority, and they're being replaced by individuals who do not know Braille. So when you go back to this community advisory committee that I'm pushing you toward, let me tell you, one of the things that you need to really push a district to do is when they write the job description for a paraprofessional that they want to be a Braillist, the job description needs to say that, because if it doesn't, guess what? The next person that comes along will not have to know Braille, but they will have to know that if it's written in the job description. So that's another way that you can be very important and influential in your school district.
I'm Sam Chen from Saratoga. I have one comment and one question. I deeply appreciate what you have done to the education of the blind, and I would like to have some, you know, discuss with you after this convention. So if you could give us again your email slowly, that's one. And two, you talk about the low instance disability of the blindness, and I wonder, you know, how you address the PE, the physical education issue.
in your educational plan? Thank you.
Okay, let me again slowly tell you my email address at work. It is L Wyatt, and that's spelled W-A-T-T, at CDE, California Department of Education, .ca.gov. In terms of PE, that is an avenue that can be addressed in an IEP. Again, a student can get PE through a regular PE class if that's determined to be appropriate, and that student can function in a regular PE class. And maybe again, that's an area where they can function appropriately if they have a one-on-one aid. Or there could be a placement in adaptive PE where they deal with an adaptive PE teacher where PE is limited. That again is an individualized decision based on what happens in an IEP. It is definitely something that needs to be addressed. Let me tell you from personal experience, my daughter now, who is 32, is also in a wheelchair, as am I. And when she was in middle school, she was in regular PE. And I decided that she needed to have some adaptive PE because of sitting in a wheelchair. All of the students had grown tall and were playing basketball above her head. And the regular PE teacher expected her to be able to play basketball, too, with all these tall teenagers above her. And I said, no. I want her to be an adaptive PE. And let me tell you, it was a major battle. And at that time, I was teaching in the same district where my daughter was attending. So I was a teacher from 8 to 3 and a parent from 3 on. And we had some most interesting battles, let me tell you. So, yes, but that does need to be addressed.
That will be our last question, and I would like to thank you for coming today to share this wonderful information for us. And I've also given you my card, so now you know Jean and myself.
Okay,
if you ever need to gently encourage us to, you know, help out with a thing or three, we're definitely here. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am told, and I do not know if they are still in the room, but I am told that we have a couple who has become engaged during this weekend, and I would like to congratulate and have you join me in congratulating Lisa Gordon and Warren Cushman. And I understand that the wedding will be sometime, I believe, in August. So congratulations. Congratulations. Thank you very much. And we are adjourned.